Great teaching happens when teachers get time to think. Walk into an Educate classroom and you'll find a consistent approach to homework, teachers who know where knowledge gaps are, and students who are doing regular retrieval practice. With Educate, you can be free from marking homework by the end of the week. Students have now answered over 1 billion questions on Educate. If you're looking to set up centralised homework and revision in your geography department, you won't be disappointed. Your first month is free at www.educate.co.uk/geography.
Hello there and welcome to JogPod. Today I'm talking to Professor Paul Chatterton. He's Professor of Urban Futures at the School of Geography at Leeds University. Paul, thanks for agreeing to join me on JogPod today.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
In preparation for this, I've been watching an awful lot of the videos that you've produced. You've produced over 50 peer-reviewed articles and chapters in various books. You've written 10, and I've just finished your latest book, How to Save the City. It's an inspiring and instructive read. I'm going to say that at the moment. It was an excellent read.
Thank you.
The How to Save the City book is a sort of a culmination, I think, of a lot of things that you've written before. But not only that, it's a guide for action. And it made me interested in where it was that you took that path in your geography career to become committed to supporting and taking action on climate and ecological and social emergencies. When did that start? Was it at school or was it something that came afterwards?
Yeah, I think I was one of those students at high school who loved geography. I think you either love it or you hate it. And I was one that loved it. And the reason I was passionate about geography is because it allowed me to understand how the world was and how it could be better. So I wandered around Leeds in the 1980s thinking, there's got to be more to life than this, you know, living in a northern industrial city. And I think that's what started to inspire me in when I went to university, thinking about these northern cities and how they could be better, going through immense change, yeah, dealing with a lot of problems in the 90s. You know, we had Local Agenda 21. We had, you know, the big United Nations conferences on climate change. We had, you know, the ecological movement, but we had massive social inequality. So for me, I think in the 90s, that crystallized my thinking around these connections between climate, ecology and social issues. And for me now, it's a triple emergencies. But very much as a kid wandering around the world, I was like, why is the world an uneven place? Why have some people got more and some people got less? And that could be in terms of pollution, in terms of money, in terms of access to nature. And that's what really got me. That's what got me on my lifetime mission looking at that.
That's really interesting because this is my second podcast this week and I've just been talking to Professor James Essen. And he said almost exactly the same thing. One of the things that we talked about and a note that he put was, I am a critical scholar who tries to use a geographical lens to explore, question and improve the world around us. And that is the essence of a geographer.
Right. Yeah.
But it is a bit of a Marmite-y subject at times. I wonder if it's because of the way we're taught or the way we perceive the subject. But it is interesting that it is Marmite-y.
I think what brings it alive is those real world case studies that when people attach that knowledge in the classroom to real world experience, and that's really whether you have a great geography experience at school or not. And I think, you know, teachers and lecturers will get you out of the classroom. I think the great thing about geography is this idea of public geography. And I've always been a scholar activist, you know, one foot in the academy, one foot in the public realm. And, you know, for me, you can bring these issues alive on walking tours, on visiting case studies, on seeing stuff in the real world, you know, both globally and locally. So you can bring that unevenness to life, you know, like social processes, spatial processes. You can talk to people about how communities work by being in those communities and walking around them and seeing how the institutions work, what the social relationships are like, what the infrastructure is like. These are all inherently geographical issues, right? And getting out of the classroom, I think, is the key thing.
You've made lots of little video shorts as well, which I think we're linked to when we do this podcast, because you talk quite and you talk very enthusiastically and in short bursts, which I think would be great for A-level students to just get a flavour. It's sometimes it's difficult when it's just coming from your geography teacher. It's nice to have somebody else who's in an academic role saying, this is your city. This is the way to look at it. Why is the housing like this? Why is it different from there to there? You've done a whole number of those.
Yeah, and I think one of my core audiences really is that kind of age group, you know, young people, whoever, how are you on an age, you know, 15 to 30 or whatever, yeah? People who are, you know, coming into the world, trying to understand how it works and intervening, giving them some tools and hope that things can be better. I think that's my kind of calling card, you know, like, why is it the way it is and how can it be better rather than just falling into despair and hopelessness? Because, you know, there's a lot of that around for good reason. But I think geography is a hopeful discipline for me. You know, how can we actively make a better world? And I think geographers get stuck in, at their best, they get stuck in. They get stuck into policy debates with local councillors. They get stuck into industry debates, be it about the environment, or they get stuck into the classroom, right? And teaching. So it's that intervention in the world which really keeps me inspired for the next generation of geographers.
That's one of the things I want to talk about a little later on, I think, is you give a guide on how we might get out and make some changes. It's not just these are the issues, but you actually provide an awful lot of practical advice, which we'll go through. I think that's the great strength of the book. The university website notes your areas of expertise under the heading of Urban Futures, so sustainable urban development, the climate emergency, co-production, which I think is interesting, we'll unpick later, action research, housing and regeneration. And that would give us enough for a huge number of podcasts, never mind you, this is just this one. We could go on forever. But you also took time out to do some of this work yourself. In 2002, 2003, you did some volunteer solidarity work in Chiapas in Mexico.
Yeah, just after the millennium, I went to Mexico for a year or two. In Chiapas, in the south, there was a really amazing group of people, the Zapatistas, who had risen up against neoliberalism and the signing of NAFTA in 1994. And they did a big call out to international volunteers to say, look, come and work and learn from us, you know. And so I literally gave up geography for a bit of time and just became a manual laborer in the jungle. I was like building water systems, yeah, carrying cement around, helping them build water tanks. You know, these are communities where, you know, most people don't have access to government-supported infrastructure, especially water. So we raised money back in the UK from selling coffee, putting on gigs, you know. And this was a time of great international solidarity, the World Social Forum, this real sense of pushback against some of the global institutions and the Washington consensus of free market capitalism. We were like, right, you know, we really want to support groups overseas who are at the front, these frontline communities, yeah, who are really at the front line, the thin wedge of a lot of stuff we study in geography, you know, urban neoliberalism and free market capitalism, some of the bigger inequalities around that. And it was great, you know. So I learned so much from essentially living with subsistence farmers, you know, living their way. And, you know, it's this heady mix of kind of Mayan culture and kind of Marxist guerrillas. And it was really, you know, it was great. It was like, you know, life changing. So I came back to Leeds just after that, and I got a job here at Leeds University, and I started to teach all this stuff, international development, self-management, autonomous politics. And yeah, how could we, one of them said to me just as I was leaving, he said, how could you be go and be a Zapatista back in your own village? And I said, well, that's Leeds at 700,000 people, but I will try. And it was amazing. So, you know, we started to set up independent social centers and housing cooperatives. And it's like, how can we build infrastructure in cities that support people's well-being and also protects the planet at the same time? So that became my big thing, and I've been doing that ever since. So self-governing infrastructure, pushing governments to support infrastructure that will protect people and planet and not just profit.
That's really the whole aim of How to Save the City, isn't it? It's about bringing those ideas and then applying them in Leeds, or else I could apply them in Sheffield. It's empowering the individual
It is.
to create communities, to create change.
It is. And the backdrop of that is my own. I've been like the United Nations. I've been applying my own ratchet mechanism on my ideas, because over the last 20 years, I've been watching, you know, the lots of meetings happening, but not enough happening on the ground, you know, and our slow descending to climate breakdown, ecological destruction, greater social inequality, more corporate power. And I'm just like, you know, look, what more do we have to say to motivate the kind of action we want, but in a hopeful way, you know, rather than just shouting everything's terrible, the world's going to end. So How to Save the City, my latest book, is almost like a progression of the stuff I've been saying for 20, 25 years, yeah? Ever since my PhD in 98 and all the things I've been writing since. And it's like shouting louder and louder, but, you know, with a different voice, because I'm 50 now. And, you know, when I was 25, you know, I shouted in a very youthful activist way and committed to pushing through institutions and demanding a new world. And now I think there's a more gentle but still urgent process at play. You know, how do we connect? How do we treat other with compassion? How do we not get into blame while we're doing this stuff? That's the journey for me. But the need for radical change is still there, and it's been mounting every year of my academic life. And it's like, look, we need to keep saying the same things. We need urgent action. And maybe it will or it won't happen in our lifetime. But the key thing is to pass that on to the next generation in the geography classroom to say, what we can do as teachers is empower you and give you the resources and tools you need, just like people before did for us. Yeah. And be honest about the challenges, but also be honest about the solutions and act as elders and guides through that difficult world. Yeah.
And it is a difficult world for young people, I think. In How to Save the City, you start with quite frightening pictures of climate disasters. You cite dozens of people dying in Tokyo in 2018 due to the heat, flash floods killing scores of people in Germany. I was cycling through in the aftermath and that of looking at them there
Yep.
and huge amounts of damage, cyclone in Madagascar. And that engenders a feeling of climate anxiety. And it's rising in young people. I did a little bit of research, and according to a Save the Children survey, well, that's Save the Children, so you've got to question who they asked. But 70% are worried about the world they'll inherit. I looked at another global study by The Lancet. This was a global one, so it found that a perceived failure by governments to respond to the climate crisis is associated with their increased distress. And they said there's an urgent need for further research into the emotional impact of climate change on children and for governments to validate their distress by taking urgent action. So I thought it'd be interesting to ask what impression you get of young people, students that you talk to, and young people around about in the outreach work that you do.
Yeah, and this is a really critical point. I mean, mainly because I've got my own kids. I support lots of youth groups, and I've been very involved in Youth Strike for Climate Action. And I think the way I handled it in the book was to present this 10-point plan, this strategy plan. And it's like our response does need to start with kind of telling the truth and being realistic about the scale of the challenges ahead of us. But that's only the starting point. And I think very quickly we need to use that to build collective power, collective agency, collective relationships, so people don't feel isolated. I think people feel, and this is myself included, panic and anxiety when you feel disconnected, yeah, and you misunderstand some of the problems and the solutions. So I think we're trying to do two things. We're trying to bring people together, so connection is really important. But also, there's this the World Health Organization calls it the no-do gap. There's just a gap between what we know and what we do. And I think what can be quite empowering is to say, look, this is the scale of the challenges, but these are the things that we can do to get out of it. They're not false solutions that don't lock us into dead ends. And I think that's the empowering bit for me to really break down what system change is like and to amplify and promote those voices who haven't got false solutions, but have got realistic solutions. So some of the social movements, some of the breakaway local authorities, some of the kind of really progressive business community who have got the solutions we need. So the solutions are out there. I mean, golly gosh, I mean, there's so many fantastic examples ranging from community economies to people-powered housing to neighborhood energy. All the solutions are out there. It's how do we piece them together in a network to create system change? So I'm not saying nothing can be done. I'm saying everything can be done. And here's a new operating system. So the book's like a new operating system that we plug in to cities and make them work differently. And that's when I want to get people excited about that.
One of the things we ought really to talk about, because it's today, is the COP28 agreement. Now, at the top line, they're saying this signals the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. But it won't unless, and I think this is Simon Sayles' quote, unless all governments turn these pledges into real economy outcomes without delay, which is really what you're talking about. As a first response, and you haven't had a chance really to
Yeah.
talk and think this through. How confident do you feel about the COP28 agreement today?
Well, I think we've always got to calibrate our expectations about United Nations processes in a very divided geopolitical world, right? So we know that there's been 28 of these meetings and climate change and climate breakdowns have been getting more and more. So there's a direct inverse correlation between how many times people meet and the state of the problem. So, you would question the pros, maybe not the structural necessity for the United Nations, but the way it's working doesn't work, is suboptimal, yeah? Whether it's resolving geopolitical conflicts, territorial disputes or climate change. You know, there needs something needs to be fundamentally different about it. Yeah. And I think the tension is really between those small island states, right? Small nation states and the, you know, the big, the quad, you know, the likes of the United Nations, the, you know, the European Union countries, Canada, US, you know, Russia, China, Britain, you know, so the big countries with invested power in maintaining the status quo, you know, maintaining growth as business as usual, the growing economy and the carbon emissions that go with that, you know, so there's people who are demanding through that United Nations process a realignment of power, global power, isn't there? And there's ones that are holding on to that power. And like, that's a living representation. No wonder they can't make a deal. Yeah. So there's never going to be this breakaway deal that can really solve the problem, because ultimately the problem is changing this geopolitical, the structural reality of nation states in the world and their obsession with economic growth. Unless we tackle that through that process, we're just going to have a process that can't get to the heart of the problem. You know, what is actually driving carbon emissions that they're trying to reduce? Yeah, that's the fundamental thing. No, they're not going to sign up to a moratorium on fossil fuel development, which we've needed. We've known that since Copenhagen 2009. You know, we fundamentally need a moratorium on all fossil fuel extraction and an absolutely massive redistribution of wealth, which, by the way, would also include mass cancellation of debt in the global south. Those are the things we need. Those are the things that, unfortunately, United Nations process cannot bring forward quick enough.
I'm going to just ask your comment about this as well. I was on Twitter, well, X, today, and there was a user there that posted this, an inconvenient truth about the greenhouse effect. And then there was a photograph of the greenhouse. This is a greenhouse. It keeps plants warm. We put plants into a greenhouse because they grow better. Warmth is good. Promise not to share. And there, this chap's got 27,000 followers. And there are still people, despite everything, who are looking at greenhouse gases and CO2 as either a positive or as something we shouldn't be worried about.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of Earth planetary systems and their breakdown. And, you know, there are those voices out there, and I think they're getting smaller. But obviously, even if we've seen in the UK, they still shift and alter public policy, right? So there's a lot invested in misinformation and disinformation, both producing incorrect information and finding mechanisms to circulate it. And there'll be people who are sponsored to do that, and there'll be people who will do it independently and get amplified. And so you get this in other realms of life, be it ultra-processed food, be it pollution from car tires, be all the things that will basically affect the balance of power in the world and challenge corporate power and their ability to extract profits, right, from communities and nations. And so, you know, I'm a social scientist. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a climate scientist. So I'm not going to stray too far into, like, you know, pulling apart some of the arguments. But I mean, quite clear that they're not difficult to dispel if you look at, you know, the longer term, thousands year long term, you know, trajectories of accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, they're indisputable. And, it, you know, the rise in surface temperature is indisputable, and the breakdowns, the tipping points are indisputable. This is accumulated scientific evidence over many, many decades. The thing about global scientists, the international, the IPCC, yeah, is that they're a very conservative bunch with a small c. They don't like to say things quickly. And for them to come to a point in 2018 and beyond, which says, look, if we don't hold global temperatures to 1.5 degrees, no more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial average, things are, we're looking at an uninhabitable planet. For them to say that was a really big moment. And then for them to, in 2021, 2022, to amplify that and say, we're nowhere near on track, we're heading for 3 degrees. For them to say that publicly is a huge risk for thousands and thousands and thousands of very patient, dedicated climate scientists. And they've come up with this group of words. They say change needs to be rapid, immediate, far-reaching and transformatory. And like, they are running out of adjectives to describe the problem. Like, what are they going to say next? And this is a fascinating thing. They've almost said it all now. They said, look, we've said everything we need to say. You politicians just need to get on with it. And so I think it's amplifying those voices, right, rather than dwelling on some of the kind of darker corners of social media that is the task at hand, amplifying the social movements, the frontline communities, and how we can support them, yeah, and people bringing projects forward, which will be truly transformatory.
That's how you start, isn't it? In the first chapter, you talk about getting in emergency mode, getting people to understand what can be done. But it's as an emergency first responders way of looking at there's the issues. Let's now address this panic, fear, and sense of powerlessness. Let's do something about those.
That's right. I use this, I'm playing around with this term first responders, mainly because people know what an emergency first responder is. Someone on the first scene, you know, it could be like somebody helping emergency services, often known in wartime situations or kind of like volunteering community situations. We had a lot of it in COVID, yeah, with mutual aid groups. Civil society volunteering, right? But, you know, we're hit an interesting situation with climate change. We're kind of neither first on the scene nor just responding, which is interesting. So we're kind of first responders, but we're with those caveats. Now, I'm using this term first responders to play around with, but just to identify a new kind of collective actor in cities, right? Who can take on the scale of the challenge, but empower people and learn things in new ways and implement projects on the ground, which can be truly transformatory. So I don't want to get stuck into the when we use the word climate emergency, which is, you know, it's got a lot of currency these days, it can evoke certain things, right? Emergencies can mean what we call states of exception. Yeah. That's what nation states, what governments do in emergencies. They lock people down, right? They set up refugee camps, they close borders, they throw resources at it. And they do that for good reason sometimes. And so emergency for a lot of people in around the world can mean a memory of very, very horrific or traumatic situations. So I appreciate, I acknowledge that. But emergency can also be a very hopeful thing about what comes next after that emergency situation. So we need to balance this sense of fear and trauma with like this idea of emergency, that there's an immediate problem to be solved, with this sense of like getting into emergency mode means for me not just immediately responding, but building an alternative with dedication and hope and purpose that will make our immediate life better than it has been before the emergency. Right? Because what we get in emergency disaster responses is often, you know, big corporations piling in, right? Building houses, roads and whatever, and extracting more capital and, you know, creating more climate change and militarizing solutions and holding people down. And so we need a very kind of people-led, a people-centered approach to these emergencies. And that's a shift, right? That's a shift into this imagination. You know, it's like how things could be different.
Being a member of the Geographical Association, the professional organisation for teachers of geography, isn't only about your journals or your teaching resources or your discounts on CPD events and webinars or your member-only prices on books, maps and geography equipment. It's about connecting to your peers in the largest geographical education community in the UK, which reaches out and has more than 10,000 members all around the world. Join the GA. Visit geography.org.uk today.
Why did you focus on the city as your unit for the thing to be saved, rather than another settlement size or a county or a country?
Well, you're right. I mean, I'm an urban geography, so actually I use the word city as a shorthand. You know, it could be a town, it could be a settlement. So you're right. I don't just want to, because cities come in many different forms, right? Mega cities, small cities, humble cities, ordinary cities, medium-sized cities. It's more about your place, really. And I think, you know, but one of the things about, we live in a very urban world, right? No doubt. While the whole of the planet isn't covered by things called cities, by urban concrete and stuff and buildings, they do dominate the way the planet works. And that works through not just people in particular places, but flows of goods and money, right? So one of the key things about, you know, some geographers call it planetary urbanization, that it's what happens that cities become these nodes for high levels of consumption and production. And that's what's driving climate breakdown and nature loss, yeah? That the urban world counts for 75% of greenhouse gas emission, right? And energy use and GDP output. So these are the engines of that kind of, let's call it that capitalist growth economy with high throughputs of goods, export orientated from the global south to the global north. Those mega cities expanding in the global south are expanding for a particular reason. Precarious labor, which is servicing a middle class in other countries. So we have to understand how our urban world works and how we then start to change it, because there's nothing instinctively socialist or capitalist about a city. It's what people make of it. And what I want to say, my big thing is like, so what is the next iteration of the city? I'm not talking about you know, going back to some 19th century city or some 20th century industrial city. But the emergencies we face provides an opportunity for us to rethink what cities are about. Yeah, because cities will change in every generation and every era. People give them a new purpose. So the city almost becomes this thing we can use to think through how we're going to live differently together. Yeah. If imagine a world where we're disconnected from fossil fuel use, right? Where we've got community energy, where work is really different, where we get around differently, where we shop and leisure differently. What would the city actually look like? What would our places actually look like then?
You've talked about what you call a decade of transformation for these places.
Yep, that's right.
And talk me through it. What does that mean?
Well, so the decade of transformation kind of comes from this idea from 2018, where basically the United Nations kind of process was saying, we've really got to get to zero carbon emissions by the 2050s, but we've got to kind of get halfway by the 2030s. Yeah. And so I suppose the global media were like, okay, it's 2018. 2030 is about 10 years away. So we've got this massive decade ahead of us. We've got to halve carbon emissions, right? Global carbon emissions. And every place has got to halve their emissions. And this is pre-COVID, right? Pre-UK and pre-Gaza, you know, so it was a different world. And it was, but that looked like a massive decade of transformation. So that's where this idea comes from of 10 years to save the planet, you know, 2020 to 2030. If we don't get halfway by 2030, we're going to really struggle to get the rest of the way, to get to zero by the 2040s, 2050s, yeah? So think about that trajectory downwards. Draw yourself a graph in your mind. I've got some in my book, you know. How do we get on that descent curve? If we don't get on that descent curve now, if we do it later, it just becomes steeper, yeah? And the longer we leave it, it just gets steeper and steeper. And the steeper it gets, if we leave it too long, it just becomes a cliff, a vertical cliff, a 90-degree drop, which is impossible.
That's the problem I have with some of these targets, because you don't have to do anything until just before the target. And in political terms, that means you don't have to do anything because you might not be in power.
That's right. And I think every day of inaction is a day wasted. Every day where we're not radically reducing carbon emissions and reversing nature loss, but also doing it in a socially just way is a day wasted. And we're heading towards a date in the not too distant future where we'll only be able to rely on magic bullets and big tech solutions, geoengineering solutions, which are untested, untried, and very expensive. So all the easy wins went decades ago. Yeah, we could have done this in a very kind of like graceful process from the 1990s when everyone was saying, let's make some big changes now. And we left it and we left it and we left it. Everyone's hoping. The thing about humans is we love technology. We love shiny new things, right? And I think we're all waiting for that magic bullet. You know, be it a new Tesla car or whatever. And I think our global age has a big faith in new tech, which is, you know, a blessing and a curse.
I think one thing that would be interesting for students to look at that you talked about is the ecological and carbon footprint of their own city and see how much further it extends than the city limits. I know students will already look at where their clothing comes from, but there's a whole area here to investigate just what is the city's ecological and carbon footprint. What's mine, but what's the city's, and what's additional?
That's right. And what I encourage people to do in the book is get away straight away from individual carbon counting, like what is my individual carbon footprint? Because some of it you can't do anything about because of the country living, but it just encourages you to think about lifestyle choices around diet and light bulbs, which are important. They're the easy ones. Just do them tomorrow and do them. That's it, right? You know, shift to car journey, cycling if you can. But the bigger picture is, so what I do in the book is I differentiate between what's called scope 1 and 2 emissions and scope 3 emissions. So scope 1 and 2 emissions are those carbon emissions that happen in the city, like, you know, from basically from cars, boilers, factories, right? And scope 3 emissions are those imported into the city from embedded in the carbon in consumer goods from all over the world, or from flying from aviation of people from that city who are flying elsewhere in the world. Yeah. And then if you, like my own city Leeds, they calculated that the scope 1 and 2 carbon emissions are about 4 million tonnes a year. So 4 million tonnes. But if you calculate the scope 3 emissions, it's 11 million tonnes. It more than doubles. Because all the stuff that comes into Leeds to support life in Leeds, you know, be it clothes, water bottles, computers, these keyboards, anything, right? It all comes from somewhere else. So it's a big agenda for localising the economy. It's not an agenda for impoverishing other countries that export. It's an agenda for global connection, but like creating nationally sustainable economies, yeah? And more balanced work, you know, more balanced and more stable work.
That's an interesting one for geographers as well, because it isn't just the climate emergency. I think this is a quote from the book, but is the climate emergency really the big one that will engulf all of us? The climate, social, and ecological emergencies all go hand in hand. So we have to not just we have to look beyond just the climate emergency with the strategies that we're developing in the future. And I think this is a big point in your book, so that we want to make sure that what we do when we change is not only responding to climate, but it's also socially and ecologically fair.
That's right. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, and this is a lot of people in the world, a zero carbon world just isn't worth it if it doesn't change their lives. And I think we just need to realize that, especially rich, you know, middle class consumers in the global north. You know, if it doesn't make people's life better, then actually, you know, fundamentally, what is the point in creating a zero carbon world if it still remains some kind of social prison with precarious labor for a lot of people? What's the point in sitting in that corporate coffee house that we all do, having a nice zero carbon latte, if the people working behind the counter are still on, you know, less than minimum wage, right? If the supply chains are still impoverishing workers, yeah? If people don't feel empowered, you know, if the coffee beans are not organic, you know. So what are we changing? You know, we can create a zero carbon world. You know, a lot of people talk about a very dystopian future. The state could wade in and create it tomorrow. And restrict our behaviors and create some kind of khaki green state, as they call it, yeah? And that wouldn't be a very, it'd be zero carbon, but it wouldn't be a very nice place to live. So, got to create more social freedom, zero carbon with more social freedom, not just for people, but for animals. So, this is why nature recovery has got a bit out of it, because if we don't crack a new relationship with our fellow species, and it feels a bit like glib to say this, people, oh, look, it's caring for animals. It's like fundamentally, they are a life support system. If we don't support other life patterns on this planet, we humans won't survive either.
Do you talk in terms of a systematic way to approach this? And you talk, which actually makes up the much of the book, is there are three aspects to approach this emergency change in a city. And the first of these is strategy. You talk about strategy first. What does that involve?
That's right. So I've got this kind of 10-point plan and this strategy. I divide it into three phases, learn, act, and build. So I think the first stage is learning. I call it learning and unlearning. Learning new ways of living, learning how to support grassroots community projects, learning how to run the state better, learning new business practices, but unlearning some of those mindsets around consumerism, yeah, around dependency on some certain kinds of work, unlearning certain ways that we have to do this and we do that are the assumptions of our life. So that learning and unlearning process is really important. And then acting is like, you know, how do we resist and push back? So, you know, at some point, those of us that can have got to kind of like create a bit of resistance in the system and say, look, no more, you know, no, we don't like this, we don't want this, we're not going to do this. And then building, you know, building alternatives. So you can't just resist, you've got to create as well. That's what gives us the passion and the empowerment. So we've got to the last bit is building. So building alternatives, be it, you know, community gardens, be it new forms of eco housing, be it recycling projects or, you know, like cycle projects, whatever turns you on, whatever's your thing, is getting involved in building alternatives, which then could be replicated. So that's the learn, act, build strategy. It's threefold. And I think, you know, it's based on quite a lot of previous work over the years by social movement practitioners. And I think it gives us a real sense of the three things we're doing in our strategy.
You also talk in this first strategy section about thinking like a city and taking a helicopter view, which I think is another way of looking at a problem geographically, because it involves then looking at housing and transport and water and sewage and the whole thing as an entity.
Yeah, and I really wanted to throw this one in because as a geographer, it's like, you know, you come across a lot of policy thinking, which is quite naive. And what I wanted to say, what I wanted to stress in this bit was, this is about the learning and unlearning bit, which is cities can't act in isolation. They can't change themselves on their own terms with their own resources. You know, all places are massively connected. Ideas, people, resources, whatever, you know, result, they come in and out all the time. And I think recognizing those flows and those interconnections are key to start to thinking like a city. We can't think about this naive place localism that a place can change itself and the resources it has. You know, it has to start to think about solidarity, connection, and the bigger connections it has with other places it will connect with to make these bigger changes. It can be exemplars, but then, you know, you get all these perverse outcomes. So if a place becomes really cool and interesting, loads more people move to it and it creates new problems of overheat, right? And more pollution and traffic and stuff. So, like, you just cannot act in isolation in a globalized world.
You also talk about communities or groups of people going upstream in terms of, it's another geographical analogy, really, but going upstream from where we are because we can't just resolve problems from amongst ourselves.
That's right. So, connecting downstream actions with upstream causes. So all too often we'll spend time going, shall I, you know, this ethical choice or that ethical choice? And actually, what I'd encourage you to say, look, you know, we need to frame everything within bigger structures of power upstream. You know, who's allocating resources? Who's giving planning permissions to supermarkets? Who's saying there can't be a cycle lane there? Who's stopping eco houses being built there? So we've only got a limited amount of time in the day. And what I'm suggesting to people is that in our strategic approach, we don't spend all the valuable time we've got on downstream, small kind of lifestyle changes. I'd rather people didn't. I'd rather people just kind of made a few bad choices. I mean, I do. I mean, it's not like good or bad, really, but you know, it's a few average choices. Just go and have a, you know, average sandwich or an average drink, but spend a bit of time rejecting a planning application, right? Or joining a local group or doing some shareholder action, you know, some of the bigger stuff that will lead to wider systemic change. Yeah. So you can balance focusing on yourself with connecting and building collective agency. I'm not saying burnout, by the way, because another key thing is, like, don't ground ourselves into the ground. Self-care and care for others is super important.
The interesting thing as well, which you do, is you break down all the various agents, all the players, the different people who have a finger in the pie.
That's right. So I've got these nine players. So the game, the book, as you've probably realized, it's kind of written like a game book. So it has strategy players and these moves. So the second part of the kind of game to save the city, literally, is these players, and there's nine of them. And what I do is I take personas that already exist in civil society. So the architect or the planner or the engineer or the teacher. And I say, what would happen if we flipped it? What would happen if the teacher, rather than just reproducing institutions, started to relearn community and start to embed alternatives? What if the city planner, rather than working in silos, started to reach out and connect across the department? So I flip the traditional role of each of those players into a new place. And I call that the breakaway coalition. So if all these players get together, they already get together, but they repeat the status quo. They keep it all going. Now, what I'm saying is, they all still need to get together. We all need them, but we need them to part this breakaway coalition. So they'll go to their day job and they'll say, I'm not going to do this any longer. I can't just do what I did yesterday. I'm going to do it differently. And so that's the breakaway bit.
There's difficulties inherent in that for teachers. If they ended up, say, using the quote from Extinction Rebellion, we're facing an unprecedented global emergency. Life on Earth is in a crisis. You then go against the DfE guidelines for using particular groups in your lessons, in your activities. I know it's a tension for some teachers, for how far can I go in talking about practical action rather than just offering the issue up for them to consider.
That's right. And the strategies for each of these players will land very differently in different places. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've got relative freedoms here in the in you know, Northern Europe, but in other parts of the world be very less freedoms to pursue a very different persona. And I think, you know, it's about building up a strategy which is sustainable and safe in your locality. But I think, again, it's building that collective agency. So here in Leeds, with Climate Action Leeds that I'm supporting, we're developing a climate curriculum for teachers. And they can embed that and then teach it. And it's, you know, it's compliant with all the exam boards. So I think it's about getting together with your kind of peer group and saying, you know, what are the parameters we can work with and how can we shift that? Like in the business community, some amazing examples out there. Patagonia, Faith in Nature, who are changing the deep purpose of business, you know, saying, you know, no longer were we just going to extract profit, you know, we're going to give profit back for people and planet. And questioning why they're there, you know, and what their purpose is, I think is a key starting point.
Once you've got, yeah, I do like the playful approach, by the way. It's an interesting one. So once you've got the players, then you've got the moves that those players need to make. And that's getting into emergency mode with each of them and where we take it further forwards. So what's the first moves?
Yeah, so then I go on to these moves, which are like all these players can take. And I think, again, it's like big radical but doable system change. So the first one's around transport. I call it cartism, but like, you know, other forms of isms over the years. There's basically a set of prejudices, right? A set of problems. And I think what I say, carism is a problem. It's not necessarily the car itself. It's life that's dependent on the car. So rather than this being anti-car, being blaming people for driving, after I say, look, how can we identify how life is locked into the car? How can we unlock it from the car? How can we unlock cities and places from the car? And I look at all sorts of interesting, you know, examples. You know, the 20-minute neighborhood is very controversial, but it's become, you know, it's got a lot of bad press recently. But it's essentially this beautiful ancient idea of creating compact cities. Yeah, connected and compact places. It's been grabbed hold of by the motorist lobby, who have tried to say, you know, you're trying to keep me in places, but actually it's quite the opposite. It's a spatial plan for freedom, yeah? Because it's the car that takes our freedom away. And it's interesting because we just need to flip these discourses on their head. So the 20-minute neighbourhood, beautiful compact places where local services, local goods can be traded. And it's not to say you have to stay there, you know? We make choices how we organise society.
It's interesting, that one, because you see some people saying, oh, I want to go back to what it was like when there was a corner shop. And then in the next breath, they're complaining about the 15-minute, the 20-minute neighbourhood because of the way that some of these are being politicised, I think. They see them in a different way.
That's right. And I think there's a couple of things that are coming together here. One is that kind of like our deeply unequal economy has created a lot of people who feel very disenfranchised. And whatever happens, they feel that stuff's done to them. And I think we have to respond to that. You know, Brexit was a great example, and, you know, the kind of rise of Trump and other people in other countries. And it's like people feel disenfranchised and don't know where to turn, right? So they'll turn to right-wing ideas. But I think the other thing is how we haven't celebrated what the alternatives really are. We haven't shown them the examples of, like, you know, what it does look like to lead a meaningful life. So it's a vision of abundance and not scarcity. Whereas I think sometimes when kind of activists portray stuff, it sounds like a manifesto for less. Things being taken away. You know, I'm going to wear a hair jumper and I can only eat, you know, lentils and all that kind of classic stuff. You know, even though I do all that as well. But there's a new era of abundance waiting, you know, which is if our cities are like leaky buckets, value is extracted from them by global corporations, right? And if we plug those leaks, there's a phenomenal amount of wealth waiting to be had by city dwellers to create all the things they want. And here's my big thing, is that what I say to people is that if they say, look, you know, you're not taking my car away from me, I'd say, look, I don't want to get involved in you and your car, but what is your need? What's the need that your car meets? And they'll say, oh, I want my kids to be safe. I want to get to the swimming pool. I want to just better get to the shop. And I say, look, let's organize society so that need is met in a way that doesn't hurt people and planet. So I want to meet people's needs, not take away the stuff that they like. I want to, how can we meet their needs in other ways that doesn't hurt people and planet?
Some of the more tricky ones for geographers, perhaps, is you talk about, there's a little section about your flight is cancelled and we're on the rocky road to jet zero.
Yeah, and there's, you know, this is a big hot topic in academia, fly less movements anyway, because, you know, one of the biggest components of universities' carbon footprints is flying, business travel, international business travel. And universities are scratching their heads about it. And I've done some research on this, looking at, you know, how do we encourage more, you know, less flying in universities? How do we use digital technologies? How do we incentivize travel patterns in different ways, give more people time to travel and all that kind of stuff, yeah? And I think it's a big one to crack, because it goes to the heart of, like, people's sense of themselves and right, that I'm a global citizen, I can travel the world, I'm a geographer. But we just have to, there's two things here. One is that we can travel, we need to be incentivized to travel by land when we can, because it's really cool and we can make that into, like, actually part of the activities in its own right. And the university and the schools need to find ways that they can subsidize that. And the other thing is we just need to find, you know, use digital technologies better and fly sometimes, but less. You know, we don't have to be frequent flyers. You know, some of my colleagues fly all the time and I'm just like, you could just fly a little bit less and still have the same prestige and connection.
That's interesting about how many people don't feel part of it, which you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago. So that if they're not empowered and they're not involved, then they do feel that it's being done to them. What strategies have you been using to address that social injustice, that nature and biodiversity loss in Leeds?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things in the book is that you know, the move about, you know, we need a really new form of democracy, yeah, and like engaging people differently. So in Leeds, we did a citizens' jury on climate change. So we did 8 weeks, one evening a week. It's a deliberative process where you explain climate change, climate breakdown, and then they come up with solutions. And the solutions they came up with, a bit like the UK citizens' jury on climate change, were really radical. You know, they wanted free buses, they wanted, like, you know, all houses to be retrofitted, all the stuff that we'd come up with. But they went through that. This is a randomly selected group of people, yeah? Calibrated to kind of actually reduce the amount of people who had really positive, strong climate views, right? And people at the end were like, well, we need to do this stuff then. So I think if you take people through a process of education, facts, it really does change people's minds. But there's other really cool stuff to be done. There's like participatory budgeting, you know, slice off bits of the budget and let people decide how it's spent. Crowdsourced manifestos like they did in Manchester or Reykjavik. So there's loads of great ways to make people feel empowered and included. But we really need to turn the town halls on their heads, you know, because they're really not. They're 19th century institutions trying to solve 21st century problems. And they really need a bit of sorting.
At the end of the book, with all this sorted, particularly the town halls, you give us a vision of the future and you talk about it's the 2030s and we're saving the city. And I thought it was a bit of a nod to Dave Hicks' preferable future. It's where we want to go. Just give us a little bit of a vision of your 2030s city on the way to being saved.
Yeah, well, the last chapter, and I didn't know how to end the book, so I kind of wrote it in this kind of, you know, it was a bit of an experimental writing, really. I wrote it from the perspective of a teenager who had their birthday, you know, and they were like navigating around this place that had been transformed. And for me, the elements were, you know, they were getting out of bed and they were able to, like, you know, go to school a bit later and cycle there, and like their mum and dad were working locally, so they spent more time together. They did a lot of volunteering, you know, and there was some big legislation which had changed stuff. So the house was a co-op and they could afford their house and there was free energy and there was free public transport and a free tram. And life was just easy and beautiful and great, graceful and connected. You know, it was the ability to just lead a daily life for everyone was just really straightforward and really, really empowering. And I think it's making those big public policy changes about how we can organise our cities better. And they were facing, you know, they were realistic about some of the big changes. So, you know, I mentioned in that last chapter, there was still refugee centres and people like who were, you know, displaced people from frontline communities who we were still showing solidarity with. So the world was still in turmoil a little bit, but we were on that trajectory towards zero carbon and people felt positive about that year on year changes and they could see those changes. But it all starts with big social policy changes at the national level, you know, committing to free public transport for everyone, you know, committing to nationalised energy, you know, committing to city-owned renewable energy corporations, some of those big choices that we can make as a city, you know, wealth taxes that would plug some of the gaps, you know, so we could restore and regenerate nature, so we could, every community could have a tram or a free bus system, then we could reduce the highways and, you know, so it really fundamentally, you know, reducing housing debt so people have to work less. Some of those big choices we can make so people's lives could be better and we could start, because it's not really about tackling climate change. You know, we tackle climate change to tackle the cost of living crisis, for example.
It's interesting because you talk about creating city wealth. This is a way of creating city wealth in a different way. It's a different political model for creating wealth.
Yep, and that's it. And we're on the verge of it. There's fragments of this all over the world. And I think we just need to consolidate them and wrap them up and say, look, cities can be this, not, people call cities this engine of prosperity, but what they mean is an engine of growth for corporations who will use cities to extract profit from them. But what I'm talking about is every inch of valuable city land being used to create wealth, which stays in there and is recycled into communities, which creates this new era of prosperity for us all. Amazing schools, amazing parks, you know, some kind of, like, you know, a renaissance, a proper renaissance of cities.
Finally, I'm going to ask you whether you've got plans to develop this and export it to other cities. How do you see this going in the future?
Yeah, well, I've got the website howtosavethecity.org. You know, I'd like to. I'm starting to create kind of guides for policymakers and practitioners. I'd like to connect with teams in other cities. I'd like to kind of go at case studies of great things at work, and yeah, I do a lot of kind of like informal kind of chatting and mentoring policymakers and activists and practitioners. But I'd like to do that more formally. You know, I'd like to do some media work around it, like more like this, and just get the message out. You know. I think what we've got now is this whole wave of global metro mayors, and I think that's where the power is. I'd love to engage with mayor offices. People want to break away. People who say, look, I'm going to put that emergency rhetoric into practice, and we haven't been really doing that since 2018, and we need to make that shift now, and these are the kind of things. So I want to be a part of a community of practitioners that can support those leaders to make that shift.
Finally, I'm going to ask you for any advice that you'd like to give to teachers. It's a really tricky issue, and how they present that to young people in a way that's as enthusiastic as you manage to present the future, which is potentially dire, but could possibly be very hopeful.
I mean, maybe start with the positive examples, field trips, visits, yeah, of like great stuff, and start from that and get then use that as questions. How are these solutions to climate change? You know, so start with the positive examples. Get out of the classroom. You know, I live in this straw bale housing community in Leeds, and it's like, how do we make our lives a living example? Because listen, you know, we all remember those amazing teachers. So teachers being that living example of those alternatives will go that mile to steady people's anxieties in these difficult times.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today. It was a great read preparing for this. The book is a great read. It's thoughtful, it's exciting, and it's inspirational, I think, for both, well, I was going to say for teachers and pupils, but for everybody, for activists, for anyone who cares about the climate crisis. It's a brilliant book. It's a brilliant read. And it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure as well. Thank you very much.